Dig, man, there goes Mac the Knife. The shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them a pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mac Heat, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's Mac Heat, dear? So there's not a trace of red. On the sidewalk, Sunday morning, even, lies a body oozing light. Someone sneaking around the corner. Is this someone, Mac the Knife, from a tugboat by the river? A cement bag's drooping down. Yes, the cement's just for the weight, dear. Bet you Mac he's back in town. Look a year, Louis Miller disappeared, dear, after drawing out his cash. And Mac Heat spends like a sailor. Did our boy do something rash? Suki Tawdry, Jenny Diver, Lottie Lanier, Sweet Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, dear. Now that Mac Heat's back in town.
Take it, Satch.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and today's program is made possible by Comcast of Sacramento and the First Amendment of the Constitution of these United States. Today's program includes from Bill Moyer's Journal of May 1st, 2009, U.S. Torture and Consequences. Bill Moyer sits down with Bruce Fein, former Deputy Attorney General under President Ronald Reagan and Chairman of American Freedom Agenda. And he also has Mark Danner, who has been reporting on the U.S. treatment and interrogation of detainees for the New York Review of Books. Also on the program, the journal profiles Steve Meekum, a Massachusetts community organizer fighting to keep working people in their homes. And then, later on, from March 24th, 2009, Scott Horton interviews Juan Cole. Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, discusses the humanitarian crisis caused by the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the misinformation at the heart of most anti-Islam rhetoric.
You know, there was one, I have a million stories, but there was one time that they started painting all the barges before we welded them, and they painted them with this epoxy paint, and when you welded on them, it turned into cyanide gas. And we actually had to wage a struggle so that we wouldn't be breathing cyanide. So there's all these struggles going on there that made class in this country crystal clear. To the degree that class had been a kind of an understanding I had from thinking about it or reading about it or things I had experienced as a young person, as a child, now it was something extremely visceral, you know, that moved it from my head to my gut, and it greatly influenced my subsequent organizing around housing. These are all protest signs. We have a million of them. So I've got to pick out the ones that are useful for the Bank of America protest. We have a strategy at City Life that we describe at each bank tenant meeting that we call the sword and shield, la espada and el escudo. The shield is the legal defense, and the sword is a public relations, public protest offense. And we find that the two work extremely well in combination. Well, this is our Bank of America puppet, and who is doubles as our Deutsche Bank puppet and several other greedy people. But we have this sign that hangs on his teeth that says Bank of America, and on the other side it says, I want your bailout and your homes. A legal defense is not enough, because in Massachusetts the banks can evict you for no reason. And so for many people, the strongest legal defense will simply slow the bank down. Slowing the bank down, however, can be very, very important, because it gives us a chance to use the public protest to good benefit.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, greedy banks have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho.
Greedy banks have got to go.
We are here in front of Bank of America because we are demanding that the bank take the rent of people who live in foreclosed buildings instead of evicting them. We're demanding that Bank of America sell those properties at real value to the occupants instead of evicting them. We are here demanding that we want to give money to the bank, and the bank won't take it. Instead, they want to evict us.
So if the bank is facing the prospect of a long, drawn-out legal procedure, even one that they might ultimately win, that is both time-consuming and expensive.
Banks get bailed out!
People get thrown out!
Banks get bailed out!
People get thrown out!
And if at the same time they're going through that, they're being regularly protested by City Life, or they have public officials calling them, asking them why a bank that just got taxpayers' bailout money should be evicting people who are willing to pay rent, that is a public relations battle the bank loses every time. So faced with that combination of long drawn out legal defense and public protest, the banks are very often choosing to negotiate and settle with us.
No foreclosures!
No eviction!
No foreclosures!
No eviction!
City Life, if it's known for anything, it's known for demonstrations. And we do a lot of them. The most famous of recent times are eviction blockades that are right in front of somebody's house being evicted.
Today we are witnessing a courageous woman taking a stand based on principle.
The point of that is pretty clear. We're trying to stop the bank from coming through our lines to evict the family. One reason we do the blockades is because they get a lot of publicity. If 50 or 75 people come and sit in front of a building and there are folks willing to be arrested, that is dramatic, and it gets a lot of publicity.
Shame, shame, shame.
I think organizing is a lot about morality. A lot of ways in which people are oppressed is presented to them as normal. They may really get the fuzzy end of the lollipop, but it's presented to them as just normal. It's just, you know, I've had big real estate corporation representatives say to me as they're evicting everybody, nothing personal, it's just the market. And so a lot of our job is to apply a moral lens to this thing that you're not supposed to apply a moral lens to, which is the market. So that if you're evicting people in order to make profit, and it's just extra profit, you don't need that money to run your building, then it is appropriate to say, that's immoral. Or if you're a bank evicting people for no reason, and you're going to cause untold suffering all over the city and the state and the country, just because you don't think you want to be a landlord, that's immoral. And people have to bear the moral responsibility of their actions, even if they're doing it through the market. And so bringing the moral lens to that stuff really helps our people and helps us organize the resistance. As part of the shield and the sword method, there is also a legislative part to our program.
Well, we're on this tour bus today with legislative aides and with press people to give people an understanding of what the foreclosure crisis is like in a hard-hit neighborhood in Boston, the Four Corners neighborhood of Dorchester. A lot of the legislative aides that have come on the bus are sponsors or supporters of key legislation that the Massachusetts Alliance Against Predatory Lending is sponsoring. And so this tour is very important in terms of showing the real need for that legislation and showing the need for the resistance.
This is really criminal what's going on, so it seems appropriate to put up on the building that this is a white-collar crime scene. We just, you know, this is a crime scene, white-collar crime scene. We're going to put it right up here on the porch.
So right now in my rectory, I have two people staying in my living room because they're homeless, because they lost their house, they have no place to go. This is the problem we have.
We need to have our neighbors to be able to stay in their homes and to be able to live here and to keep it the thriving community that we've worked so hard to bring it to be.
When a person comes to their first rally, it is a very scary thing to kind of raise your voice in a public setting like that. And when you do it, and you kind of overcome that and join in the chants or lead the chants or speak at a rally.
And it was five foreclosures that I was able to stop five times. And I told them, unless you have...
It's very transformative. People find their voice that way. And I've seen it happen a lot of times that people in moments of struggle become different people. They become better people.
It seems like just yesterday that we stood in front of my property almost in the same way, yep. A lot of the same people defending the same cause. I don't know where that strength came from to do what I did. When I think back, like the me that I know would have just moved out. And I always say to people, they're like, I'm like, foreclosure was kind of like one of the best things that happened to me. And they're like, huh? Like, but so much good came from it. I was able to help so many other people. I learned so much good information that if I had had before, you know, but I can turn it on to other people and help them not make the same mistake. And I kind of feel like it gave me my calling. It kind of put me where I needed to be.
I'm a working American. I work 60 hours a week sometimes. I have the money to pay the rent. The realty company won't take the rent payment. And I thank God for the struggle and the unity of the people that are out here trying to fight this fight on behalf of the whole community.
We will not let Reggie and his family be evicted, will we?
No!
I think that the process by which people, number one, go from feeling like victims to being activists on their own behalf, and then they take a step beyond that and they become activists on other people's behalf, other people who were in the same situation they were in.
Just last question, what's it doing to the neighborhood? Just real briefly, what kind of an effect?
And then they become activists on other issues besides housing, and pretty soon they're trying to change the system. And the process by which people go through all those stages is a vital part of community organizing. It's not only a community organizing way of building, being, and not only builds organization, that it does, but if empathy is somehow the quintessential human emotion, the quintessential thing that makes us human, then solidarity is its expression.
We close each meeting with a solidarity clap, so if you wouldn't mind standing up.
And I think that that experience of solidarity is something that feels so good that people come back just for that.
Gonna beat, back, bank, attack, gonna beat, back, bank, attack, gonna beat.
That's it for the Journal. Log on to our website at pbs.org for more about the foreclosure crisis and to find community organizers in your area. There's also a complete guide to our coverage of banks and the bailout, and a history of the controversy surrounding the torture of terrorist suspects. My conversation with Bruce Fine and Mark Danner continues online. Log on to the Moyers website at pbs.org, search Moyers, and click on Bill Moyers Journal. I'm Bill Moyers. See you next time.
The last man nearly ruined this place. He didn't know what to do with it. If you think this country's bad off now, just wait till I get through with it.
For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. And it's my pleasure to introduce Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. He writes the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. And welcome back to the show, Juan.
Thanks so much, Scott.
And you're on a book tour right now for your brand new book. Is that right?
That is correct.
And it's in the mail, but too late. But it's on its way. I can't wait to read it. What's the name of it?
It's Engaging the Muslim World.
Engaging the Muslim World. That sounds like a good idea for a book, rather than, say, obliterating them all, which apparently has been the policy.
Yes, it's amazing if you think about it. In the last few years, the United States has invaded two major Muslim countries and militarily occupied both of them. This is something that hasn't been done since World War I.
Right, and of course the regime change in Somalia, I don't think, went unnoticed, even though it was only a few American soldiers on the ground, mostly a Ethiopian thing.
That's right. Well, there have been lots of interventions, of course.
Yeah. Well, and you know, here's the thing, Juan. I've done a couple of radio interviews with right-wing war party hosts in the past couple of weeks as the anniversary of the Iraq War has come up, and, you know, in the name of antiwar.com, defending my point of view from them. And apparently there's an entire giant faction on the right that says the Iraq War is basically great, that everybody there still, like they used to say back in 04, they're way better off now than they were under Saddam Hussein, and the whole thing's a great success thanks to General Petraeus and the rest of these things. So I was thinking, you know, not that I can't refute these lies pretty well myself, but I thought it would be nice to give people an opportunity to hear, you know, an actual State of the Iraqi Union kind of report about how that country really is doing after all these years of American occupation.
Well, how people are doing would depend on what your ultimate interests were. Obviously, the people you're talking about don't care that there are 4 million displaced Iraqis huddling in shelters and or abroad, running out of money, whose lives have been disrupted. That's 4 million out of 27 million. That's a big proportion of the country that's homeless. And then you have another big proportion that's been killed or wounded. So, you know, if your criterion is that they've had a few elections and they had to lock down the country to have them, then you can declare that it's all a great success. But if your interest is the welfare of the people, then it's hard to see it as a success. Then if you're talking about U.S. Interests in the region, the Saddam Hussein regime was horrible, but it was a bulwark against Iranian influence in the Middle East. You've now got a government in Baghdad, which the American right will never admit, but it's run by the Islamic Mission Party, which is a Shiite fundamentalist party that is close to Tehran. And so Iran's power in the Middle East has been quadrupled by the Bush administration's actions. So you've got
that faction you refer to, that's the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution?
Well, no, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which has changed its name, says it's now the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq because the revolution has already occurred.
Yeah, they were successful in that part thanks to the 3rd Infantry Division of the U.S. Army.
That's how they view what has happened, is that they had an Islamic revolution in Iraq. So they are the largest, the most important party in parliament, but the prime minister is from a coalition partner of the Islamic Supreme Council, the Dawah Party or the Islamic Mission Party.
The Islamic Mission Party. I guess I haven't heard it referred to as that before.
Well, it's not usually translated or it's not usually referred to at all, but it is the party of the prime minister. It did the best in the provincial elections in the Shiite South in the recent January 31st. But, you know, the American press just has an odd way of putting things. So they said that the secular party did well.
Right.
Well, does the Islamic Mission Party sound to you like a secular party?
No, although, is it true, or to what degree is it relevant that al-Maliki is actually from one faction of Dawa that is a bit less pro-Iranian than, say, Jafari's faction, and that he actually is more of an Iraqi nationalist, because I think secular, in the American media, they use those terms interchangeably, but they're saying that he's trying to govern across sectarian lines. I guess it's another question whether that's actually true or not.
Well, I mean, I think in a parliamentary system, you have strange bedfellows. The Hezbollah in Lebanon allies with Christians like Michel Aoun.
Right.
Doesn't mean that they're secular. But in any case, the point being that al-Maliki was in exile in Damascus rather than Iran. He did hang out in Iran as well. And so he's not as close to the Ayatollahs as some of the other Shiite leaders in Iraq. But he is also close to them, and he's gone to Iran a couple times and had very warm consultations. Ahmadinejad came to see him in Baghdad. So, you know, the American political elite, the politicians and pundits, just don't want to see that reality, which is that Iran is making hay in Iraq, and the new government that we installed is allowing them to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they even try to blame, or at least in years past, have tried to blame all their problems on Iran, even though the Iranians have basically been their partners in installing the Maliki government.
Exactly. The Iranians supported the elections. They supported the constitution. If you read, the Iranian press secretary, it sounded exactly like an echo of whatever Bush's press secretary was saying.
Well, and although, to be fair to the Bush regime, they didn't mean to do that, right? It was because Sistani said, hey, if you believe in God, go outside and demand one man, one vote, and Bush and Blair's plans for regime change were disrupted and replaced by the Ayatollah's plan.
Yeah, well, the original Bush administration plan was to go in, overthrow Saddam, put what they called the secular Shiites in power, because they believed that Iraqi Shiites were secular, and then leave. So then the secular Shiites in Iraq would be a game changer for the whole region. Well, it was a crackpot plan. It was based on false information, or poor analysis, unrealistic expectations, and of course it all collapsed. But what they ended up doing really was to expand Iranian power in the region, and then to ruin a lot of Iraqi lives. I think just the sheer fragility of the current situation is not widely understood. You had four bombs go off in Iraq yesterday, a couple of them pretty big bombs, and one in Abu Ghraib in west of Baghdad, another in a Kurdish city in Diyala province, and this is Arab on Kurdish violence.
25 Kurdish killed in that one.
Yeah. So that's, a shoe that could drop, Kurdish-Arab conflict. Mm-hmm. And so things are not hunky-dory in Iraq. You know, it is a basket case.
Well, and all the headlines today, in fact, are, I forget if it was the Times of London or who it was, antiwar.com. We have our own treatment on the subject by Jason Ditz about the Awakening Fighters rally against Maliki government. The former Sunni insurgents put on the payroll by General Petraeus, they were supposed to be absorbed onto the Iraqi payroll and made part of the Iraqi army at some point, but it seems like that some point keeps getting pushed off and pushed off, and they're getting mad.
Yeah. This was a New York Times story today, and it has been long known that Nouri al-Maliki, the Shiite prime minister, did not intend to put most of those Awakening Council members, the Sunni Arab fighters who started taking a salary from the Americans to fight what the Americans call Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that these guys were never going to be incorporated into the Iraqi armed forces or security agencies in very large numbers. Because al-Maliki doesn't trust them. He sees them as former insurgents and who could easily try to make a coup against them if they were in the military.
Which is true, right?
Well, he has his reasons for not trusting them. So I think some small proportion of them might be brought into the police or the military, but most of them, if they get a salary at all, it's going to be a desk job, kind of a make-work job of some sort. And the ability of the Iraqi government to give out desk jobs has declined rapidly with the decline in the price of petroleum this year. So a lot of those guys, you know, they're not even getting paid anymore. And there is, you know, worry on the American side that if al-Maliki doesn't pick these 100,000 nearly Sunni Arab fighters up, that they'll go back to taking a salary from the al-Qaeda types.
Well, so correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you have a lot better memory than I do and wrote a lot more about it at the time. I just talked about it. But weren't all the benchmarks of the surge supposed to be completed by October of 2007?
Oh,
and
yeah.
That was all the political reconciliation between the different Arab factions and the Kurds, et cetera?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they were supposed to, you know, things have been done that sort of were attempting to meet those benchmarks, but often they backfired. The new law on the treatment of the members of the former Ba'ath Party was passed, and it was passed by the hardline Shiites, and the former Ba'athists all yelped about it and didn't like it. And then Bush came out and touted it as an achievement for national reconciliation. So, you know, a lot of these things have been met in name only. You've got the Obama administration now. I've got a chapter in the book, Engaging the Muslim World, about how Iraqis and Middle Easterners saw and experienced the Iraq War and what a disaster it was for them. Even if you just took the people who were killed, wounded, displaced, you know, you've got a population here of people badly affected by this thing that proportionally would be like the entire state of California.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.